All right, everyone, welcome to our May session of the Intel Hub. Today we have Arnold Roizer presenting on his information services, and I'm looking forward to hearing his insight on open source intelligence. So Arno, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to you, and I will go on mute so that I don't disrupt your conversation.
Thank you very much, Nicole. And a very warm welcome to all the participants for wherever you are. My name is Arno Roizer. I'm here to explain a little bit on open source intelligence, my little passion. And to do this in two parts, I would like to say something about the theory of open source intelligence. That's the way that I see the theory of open source intel. And I'd like to present to you two practical examples of how to actually do it. So you've got something to take with you as well. Here's a little bit on my background. I am the founder and manager of the Open Source Intelligence Shop of the Dutch Defense Intelligence and Security Service. I joined them in the early 90s when I discovered the internet as an extra source in addition to the other sources that I already had. I tried to actually create in those days a system where I could provide answers to questions based on using sources like commercial information providers, Dialog, LexisNexis, and the like. Combine that with what I could find in traditional university public libraries, and combine that with what was back then brand new, which was the internet. And the Dutch Defense Intelligence Service liked that a lot, and they asked me to come over and find their or establish their open source intelligence shop, which I have done with great pleasure, I may say. It's really my passion, this information world. I am originally a librarian, but I've never seen a public library from the inside. I was trained actually to solve information problems, provide information solutions in order for my customers to make decisions and establish some change in something, but I'll come back to that. This is what I would like to present. As you can see, I didn't do PowerPoint anymore. I simply use HTML. Everything you see, I will put in a PDF file, and it will be put on the website. I also have for you my contact details here on the bottom right-hand side. I'll give them again later during the presentation if you have any questions after the presentations. I don't know about you, but I normally have many, many questions after somebody else's presentation, not during. Don't hesitate to mail me and ask whatever you like to know. I can learn so much from somebody else's questions. The content, I'd like to show something about what I think OSINT is and what it's not. Some ideas on how OSINT relates to secret information or covert operation. Because in my humble opinion, there's still a big misunderstanding as to that intelligence services mainly rely on secrets or something, where, in my humble opinion, the opposite is true. I'd like to tackle Google as well, which is quite tricky because it's such a large company. But I still want to say something critical about the search engine. At the same time, showing you how to use Google to find out about current conflicts between India and Pakistan in such a way that you find only a low number of results with high relevance instead of the other way around. And the second example, number six, what I would like to show is how to find out activities of Iran, in this case, not India, on chemical weapons using open sources only, in this case, a combination of commercial information providers and what you can find for free, so-called for free, on the internet, because nothing is for free. There's always a price to pay. There's a very old-fashioned and very clear Dutch expression that goes something like sunrise is for free, and all the rest you have to pay for one way or the other. But that's another presentation. Let's have a look at what I think OSINT actually is. I am assuming, by the way, Dr. Drumhiller, that all this is readable. If it isn't, give me a hint, and I can zoom in a little bit.
We can read it.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Since there were so many different definitions of what open source intelligence is, I actually created this particular definition based on many years of experience and working in the field and visiting other services, looking how they do things or they do not do things. And I came up with this particular definition. And essential in this definition is the phrase collaborative, because open source is not an island in itself. It is a collaborative effort together with all the other information collecting disciplines within the intelligence community. It's an integrated methodology, and I see it as a production process of intelligence. And that's basically what it is, a production process, where the requirements of our customers are met by providing them with intelligence based on information from open sources. And that's basically it. There is a couple of restrictions there. It should be validated. It should be reliable. I must know for sure that the information is coming from the one who says he is who he says he is. Pardon my English here, my Dutch English. It should be timely. It should be accurate. And there is a couple of other restrictions as well. One is the phrase legal. I don't do any hacking. Hacking, stealing, breaking in is something that you may be allowed to do. I don't consider that open source information because it's in many countries completely illegal. Even if I find passwords and even if I find out that getting access to a certain database is extremely simple due to any lack of security awareness with the victim, I still wouldn't use that as OSINT. I would pass that information to other departments who are specialized and authorized to use information in that way. In comes
Arno, go ahead and refresh for us. Right now we're getting a blank screen broadcasted. So if you can, please hit refresh on your screen share. Perfect.
Something like this? Excellent. Sorry
this
about
is
that.
There.
So the first phrase, restrictions, was legal, and the second phrase is ethical. Because if I really start searching, I can find things that I was probably not supposed to find, or find information that's not supposed to be in the open domain, which means that, for instance, WikiLeaks may be open source information for many. That information was never intended to be published in the open domain. There is no authors, no publishers, nobody is responsible for it. And therefore, I don't regard it as open source information. One very important characteristic of open information, open source information, is that there is somebody out there who is responsible for that information. If I can't find those, the information value drops dramatically. Of course, we're going to use WikiLeaks, but that's not my department. It's not OSINT. Many other definitions there. Here's a couple of others that I really find interesting. Open source intelligence produced from publicly available information that is blah, 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 from a US military manual. Is a form, and this is what I really object to, is a form of intelligence collection management. Open source and any intelligence effort is never about collecting intelligence. It's got nothing to do with it. You don't collect intelligence, you create intelligence. What you collect is information, which by a process of analysis or whatever you call that, is turned into a intelligence product. What I really like is the one of Joseph Nye. I actually don't know how to pronounce that family name. I just realize I only read about the man and never actually pronounce his name. It's the outer pieces of a jigsaw puzzle where you start at the corners, where you start at the sides, and you work your way in until you can't go any further. And that's where all the other sources come in. And it's really about this all-source intelligence. That's what I always stress. I never wanted to be alone in my ocean shop. I always wanted to be with all the other collecting disciplines within the service. I'll come back to some.
Arno, click refresh. Your screen keeps coming in and out, so I apologize for the interruption. I just want to make sure that everybody can see what you're seeing.
Yeah, and I'm looking at my currently sharing screen, and it simply says sharing.
Perfect.
Keep on interrupting me, because I can't see if it's online.
Excellent. We see Joseph Nye's quote, so we can view what you're seeing now.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Keep interrupting me, please. So, definitions there. And I think the one, without wanting to brag on about me, but the top definition that I have created based on many, many others is, I think, comes pretty close, I think. Now, let's have a look at some phrases that I always use. Data, information, intelligence, report, decision, and change. It's not really OSINT, but you need to realize what I mean with these phrases. Otherwise, you don't understand the presentation and you don't understand my attitude to open source intel. Life starts, life, not intelligence, because intelligence is life and the other way around. It starts with data, which is all your raw little bits and bytes that don't make any sense at all, which is by some process turned into information, which gives an umbrella view towards all the data. It puts everything in context without, however, giving any explanation or interpretation or predictions, etc. That's typical for an intelligence report, for an analysis process, where intelligence is created by human beings, not by machines, not by software. It's created by human beings, analysts or something, who create an intelligence report that actually explains what's going on, that will interpret what's going on, that will predict what's going on, that will compare, etc., etc., etc. Following that is a report. And a report can be created by our customers based on the intelligence report they got. The trick is that the report can say something completely different than the intelligence services actually advises their minister to do. To give you an example, if the Dutch Minister of Defense wants to send troops to Afghanistan, he likes to read that it is safe in the country. And if the intelligence service reports something else, he may not be very happy. Based on those reports and intelligence reports, a decision will follow, and based on the decision, probably some change, or at least a decision will influence change. My point is, intelligence is produced. My point is, decisions and change don't make any sense if there's not an intelligence report. And an intelligence report without a decision and change don't make any sense at all. Total waste of time. Now, let's have a quick look at the sources that make up the open source information world or the open source information landscape. These are all sources. This is the old-fashioned way of, the old-fashioned, this is what I call the print world, the pre-2000 way of communicating information, which is online databases, handbooks, reference works, libraries, etc., etc. And this is what I do in my back garden, if it's a beautiful weather, to read all these sources to find out where can you get what kind of information. It's not just television here, BBC breaking news. It's also online databases like, or press wire agencies like Associated Press or Agence France Presse, which is probably the best press wire agency in the world. It's also big online databases like Factiva here or LexisNexis at the top right-hand side, and Thomson Dialog, which are the big three. LexisNexis is one of the largest information providers in the world. They are even bigger as volume is concerned than Google. LexisNexis holds 8 to 9 billion documents, full text online, government information, reports, newspaper articles, market analysis, you name it, they've got it. And with a fantastic search language. There is, of course, specialized databases here on the right-hand side, BBC Monitoring Services, EMAM News Explorer, a silo breaker that actually reads 50,000 public news sources from the internet, does some pre-analysis there, network analysis, word frequency analysis, and presents it all in a personalized home screen. On the bottom right-hand side, I hope you can see that, there's a very small screen on the bottom right-hand side. These are all social media.
Arno,
yeah.
Go ahead and click refresh again for us and see if we can. Perfect. Just keep hitting refresh periodically, and I think that'll keep the screen up for us.
We'll do that. On the right-hand side, social media. On the bottom left-hand side, you see a couple of libraries. On the bottom left-hand side, the once reading room of the British Library doesn't exist anymore. Unfortunately, this reading room. Next to it is but one largest library in the world, the Library of Congress, which actually collects everything. Everything being published, they buy that and they store that. If you think that building is a bit small, it may be small, but I understand they have 8 football fields below this building, and they have 3 other buildings just like that and some other storage rooms around DC. There is many, many sources out there, and we don't even talk internet. Let's have a look at internet sources here. Here is a picture that I made. I hope this is more or less readable. Let me zoom that in a little bit to show you what the open source information landscape may look like if we limit it to the internet only. And at the bottom left-hand side, I hope you can see that here, is a little box that says World Wide Web. And for most people, the open source world or the internet is limited to just the World Wide Web, and then only a very small part. But there is so much more on the internet. Remember, we just had a look at what's available in sources in the print world. Let's now have a look at the online world, and just OSINT, not even commercial databases. On the top right-hand side, you see something like Internet Relay Chat. Now, Internet Relay Chat is roughly something 80 to 100,000 discussion channels all live on the most ridiculous concepts, the most interesting ideas and subjects. I recently had to do some research in football fan clubs. Oh, soccer fan club. And I had to do something with the FC Liverpool club. There are four FC Liverpool fan clubs that still discuss things today via their own IRC channels. If you don't know that, if you have no idea how to get access there, you may miss a lot of valuable information. And if you are in forensics intelligence, you may even miss more, because criminals know IRC, they know where to go to, and the police don't know anything, and they can't follow that, if they don't know. Another group being slightly below IRC is NNTP, Usenet discussion groups, which is also something like in the order of 60 to 100,000 discussion groups. In this case, it's client-based. It works a little bit different, but it's the same idea. And people, I believe you, in some conflict areas, do try to kill each other in these discussion groups as well. There are two kinds of those, text-based discussion groups and binary discussion groups. I have no idea why these binary discussion groups are called binary, because in my humble opinion, everything in the internet is binary. It's actually the area where people share illegally downloaded books, films, motion pictures, software, etc., etc., etc. If I want to find illegal books on how to make bombs or how to interrogate people, this is the way to go to. And I can download the most brilliant manuals on how to make your own bombs based on grandmother's kitchen, if you don't believe that. I have that book here with me. I was, by the way, strongly advised by our explosives experts never to do what's in that book. Torrents is the solution for illegally downloading books. With torrents, peer-to-peer networks, every document is separated in very small parts. And since every law allows you to have a small copy of a large item, there is no infringement for whatever law there is. In a torrent, all these little pieces.
Arno, we have a question from David in the chat. Do they mean binary as in only two people or two connections speaking to each other at one time?
Binary means legally uploaded books, uploaded software, etc. It's very confusing, that phrase. I don't know why they call it binary. It's solely exclusively for illegally uploaded films, motion pictures, music, pornography, etc.
Okay, perfect.
It's got nothing to do with twofold connections or whatever. All right, the answer helpful? All right.
Yes, that was perfect.
Excellent. So torrents solved that problem by having a piece of software that collects all these very small bits and puts it together again. And thus, you can all according to the law. The deep web is a big thing that is very largely misunderstood. Deep web is often associated with the criminal part of the internet. It's got nothing to do with it. The deep web is simply that part of the internet that search engines cannot see. And I'll show you the next picture how big that is. The deep web is simply that part of the World Wide Web mainly that is not indexed by search engines. And you can imagine that there is a lot of information out there that the Googles have no access to. Like, for instance, all these commercial information providers for which you need a password. Like, for instance, the CPRI databases in Scandinavia, the arms trader databases, because you have to fill in keywords there and other selectors to make your own little tables, and Google can't type. They can only search and index. Other types of information that's in the deep web that you will never find in a search engine is information in a format that a search engine cannot index, or information that changes too often, too fast. Let's say information like weather reports or arriving, departing naval ships, etc., which refreshes every half hour. Unfortunately, the Google indexes are only updated once every 2 days, so they can't keep up. That's why Google has all these extra and new services to present you with stock quotes and the weather and the news, etc. Deep web is not just Tor, which is, by the way, completely legal to use. It's not a problem whatsoever. Deep Web is also the Invisible Internet project, of which not many have heard. It's also Freenet. All three are completely separate environments, worlds. On some of that out there on the World Wide Web, you need extra software for that, which is for free, by the way. It's made by activists to get access to the hidden part, where you can work completely anonymous with all the advantages and disadvantages there. And you can actually create your own little web pages, websites that nobody can trace because it's not official. It took me, when I first tried to make my illegally, between brackets, deep web web page on Tor, took me about 30 minutes to do, including reading on exactly what to do. It is that simple. There is classified sources that don't belong to the OSINT domain, but I don't want to cut this little line. I think it's very important that it all gets together. And I don't want to break that line, that's why it's there. There's also on the bottom left-hand side, file transfer protocol, there's something like SMTP POP. If I ask people, do you know any part of the internet that is not World Wide Web? Nobody knows the answer, yet we know we use this every day. And there's, of course, conventional sources, handbooks, reference works, radio, television. There is many, many sources out there in print, which is much easier to use sometimes than just Google. People are completely hooked on Google. It's a big concern for me that most students think that with every answer you have to go to Google and Google will have the answer. It's also what Google tries to convince us of. Nothing could be further from the truth. As a matter of fact, if I have a class of students and I have a long course, I ask my students to do some reference work. Just look up simple questions, names, facts, numbers, and dates by using the correct sources. Question number 13 is my Pulitzer Prize question, if I may be blunt and bragging on about myself. Now, question number 13 is, what is the weather today? And believe it or not, half the class actually looks it up in Google instead of simply looking out of the window. Talk about different sources. I'll show you an example. There's many, many, by the way, that make up OSINT, but these are the main categories. I'll show you where it all gets together in a little example. Here is a phrase, I hope you can read it, found, let's say, by a police investigator on a subject. And it says something that only makes sense if you understand the previous picture. And now something funny happens, because most people who look at information that they don't understand have a very natural attitude toward that. And I'm not saying I don't do the same, I do exactly the same. If there's something I don't understand or something that goes beyond me, I have a natural tendency to say that that information is irrelevant or unreliable or any other excuse not to have to admit that I have no idea what this is about. It actually says that I have file transfer protocol, a telnet address. Telnet is a service on the internet like FTP, HTTP, etc., with which you can run the software on somebody else's computers. The telnet address to run to Shunet SE, PAP, which is a FTP directory somewhere on the Swedish University network in Sweden, just sends something via Usenet, the tarball, which is a kind of zip, but then in the Unix world, send this from a discussion group called Alt Binary Bitcrew, generate makefile using Python and run make to compile the program, use the documentation in a internet relay chat channel called Python, and get all the documentation from this .onion address. And everybody should, who is familiar with Tor, recognizes this immediately as a Tor web address. All the Tor web addresses end on the .onion top-level domain name. It is unique for Tor. If you don't understand that, and if you type that in a normal web environment, you will get a 404 error. This is an example, by the way, that I made up just to make a point. I cannot imagine that anybody would actually write this in real life. Example, OSINT search. Let's have a look at what I call the OSINT search process circle, just to get some structure in a research project. Let me try and make this picture a little bit bigger, like this. Is this hopefully better readable? It starts.
Yes, that looks
better?
Yes.
Excellent. So it starts, you read this picture clockwise. It starts on the top right-hand side with how should we prepare for OSINT research, which means some security preparations, because you wish to, during your research, you wish to protect your information profile and you want to protect your information position. The information position is what you know, the information profile is what you want to know. And in many cases, you want to keep both hidden because you don't want the entire world to know that you're trying to take over a company for a certain price, for instance. And you need some technical preparations to make sure you've got all the tools. Then there is something very important, which is basically the most important step in any online research, and that is requirement analysis and problem deconstruction. What exactly do you
want? See the chart again? It went back out. Perfect. It's there. It's back. It just keeps going in and out for us.
Annoying. What do you want? Which is the most important part of any research process. Make your research questions as precise as possible. Try to prevent assumptions. Try to prevent variables. Never ever look for the latest developments in, because we have no idea what that means. Then the next step is, what exactly are you going to do? The collection plan, then the sources that you want to use, then the kinds of search engines that we want to use. And here the figure, you see a couple of categories of search engines. Then we need to do something with terminology, because a border conflict between India and Pakistan, with all respect for these fantastic countries, can be expressed in many, many ways. It's not just border conflict. And if you don't know that, you will only find a fraction of what's out there. Then on the then we need to know how to build smart queries, the left-hand side, bottom left-hand side. Then some monitoring techniques on how to keep track of what's going on. And then some search strategies, and on the top left-hand side, a validation regime to make sure that we can actually discriminate the good from the crap. And there is a lot of crap out there. It started with Mr. Trump, who talked about fake news. Already in the 14th century, there was a big concern about the Donatio Constantini, the donation of Emperor Constantius, I don't pronounce that in English, in the 12th century, in which this emperor had given large parts of Italy and complete control of the empires to the Pope. Unfortunately, it was a fraud, completely made up, proven in the 14th century. That's how old fake news already is. It's a fantastic story if you want to read that. The Donatio Constantini. Big fun. Anyway, let's skip this figure for now, because I want to show you something on Google, where Google comes in. Here is a little picture that I've drawn to make a point. It's a bit difficult. This entire big yellow thing is representative for all the information out there, everything, the lot. Then I would put to you that the print world, the picture within the picture, here, the second row, the print world, is basically part of all the information out there, assuming that not all information is available in libraries, not all information is available on a radio broadcast or television or in newspapers. The internet is only a very small part of this print world, because the internet only exists since the 1960s, and it only has a small part. Nobody knows exactly how much. It seems much, but I can assure you that all these university libraries have collections that by far outweigh anything that's on the internet. The internet consisting of FTP, POP, SMTP, listserv, IRC, etc., etc. The World Wide Web is only a small part of the internet. And the World Wide Web consists of deep web and commercial information providers, social media, etc., etc. Now, the part of the World Wide Web that is actually deep web is, believe it or not, 98%. 98% of the World Wide Web you will not find using a search engine. It's all in the deep web, and some sources even claim that the deep web is 1,500 times larger than the World Wide Web. This means that the percentage that you can find on the World Wide Web using a search engine is less than 0.01%. The World Wide Web being made available, therefore a very small part made available through search engines, and of all the search engines, Google is only one. And this makes, with this, I'd like to make the point that please, my dear friends, look further than just Google, because it's really a fraction of what's out there. It is not representative for everything there is. And you cannot base serious research on Google alone. Now, the amount of information. I have here some phrases on the relationship between secret information and open source information, which in the 1990s was a battle that I had to go through, because many of these old-fashioned intelligence spies claimed that secrecy was the utmost goal of any service. Nothing can be further from the truth. There is basically 80% or even more of every work of an intelligence service is one way or the other based on open source information. This is a quote I found on Intel Hub. Unlike the work of intelligence services, comma, that primarily need to be conducted with the tools of secrecy. I have no idea what this is based on, certainly not on my experience. Let's have a look at what others think about open source information. Here is the Al-Qaeda Encyclopedia of Jihad. I've got both, one in Arabic and one in English, found in England in the late 90s. They say themselves that 80% of all the information about the enemy comes from open sources. And the rest, who knows? Here is one by Samuel Wilson, the former director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. 90% of intelligence comes from open sources. The rest is just more dramatic. It's about Sherlock Holmes, not James Bond. I can assure you that there is nothing more ridiculous than watching a James Bond movie if you've worked for an intelligence service for 25 years. But anyway, here is the one I really love of Joseph Nye. I already told you that. Here's the last one by Mr. Tony Zinni. 80% comes from open sources, and if he really works a little bit harder and does his best, he finds another 16% in open sources, at best only 4% from classified sources, on the amount of information. Finally, there is something like here, this temple, a picture created by the international super guru on open source intel, Robert David Steele. He made this picture to show that for a customer, it doesn't matter what's going on. The customer is only interested in all source analysis and not in where the information really comes from. And you can see here a nice distinction between open source information and open source intelligence. With that, I would like to leave the ocean theory for what it is and dive in there and see how you can actually use that in real life. Suppose here's a little bit of a mock-up example. Not really analysis, but it makes the point. Suppose that we are interested in the question whether Iran is developing chemical weapons. Based on making use of open source information as well as fee-based information. The first question I would ask is, what exactly is a chemical weapon? You may assume you know what a chemical weapon is, but it is always wise to go back a couple of steps and try to find out what exactly is that and which terminology should I use. For that, I could use documents from the Federation of American Scientists, Introduction to Chemical Weapons. I could use the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons here in The Hague. Obviously, they've got fantastic documents about chemical weapons. And maybe a little book called A Small Dose of Toxicology, or whatever sources you'd like to use for that. Then my second question is, if I find out that a chemical weapon is basically a pesticide, because that's what it is, what I want to know is how many keywords are there and synonyms and spelling variations and official names and chemical names are there for pesticides. So what I do is this. I go to Progress Dialog databases and I start a database called Derwent Chemistry Resource or Beilstein Facts or whatever. And here you can see the instruction that I had to send to the dialogue databases to actually start databases 398, 355, 306, select in the name descriptor field the phrase pesticides, map all those synonyms in a temporary set and save that for free. So I now have online a set of 100 nicknames for pesticides that I can use for my second search. Then I want to know how many pesticides were actually exported from the United States of America to Iran, for which we can use a database called Pierce Imports and Exports. And Pierce Imports and Exports actually allows you to look up which products were sold by which country to what other country. Now, there is no direct link between the United States and Iran. They're not that stupid. You have to do some extra work there, but you get the idea. You will find out something about the import in Iran of these pesticides. And here, again, for your picture here, is an idea on which instructions you need in Dialog to do that, which results in a lovely little table. Not a document and not a pile of document or a pile of paper like good old fashioned librarians do, but simply a table with the answer. In this case from Argentina, I'm not going to show you the rest. So if I know how much roughly was imported by Iran, I'd like to know question number four, how many pesticides do you actually need? per hectare of agricultural land. Well, for which you can use this particular source or any reliable source that you can find. And then the last question, how much agricultural land does Iran actually have? For which we use the good old-fashioned CIA World Factbook, about 10%. And then I make a very rough computation, simply doing some calculations there to find out that initially it looks like Iran is importing way too many pesticides to be within reason to be used for agricultural purposes. All based on open sources, commercial sources, free sources, just know what questions to ask at which point and which source to use for which question. Now, this is not an analysis. It has got not much to do with a real analysis because I only looked at what was imported from the United States via FIRE. I haven't looked at imports from other countries. I haven't looked at exports, etc., etc., etc. And I haven't also not looked at illegal imports. But it gives you an idea of what's possible there. I'll show you as a last example, because not many people have access to all these expensive sources, the last example on how to actually find out how to get a list of highly relevant documents regarding current conflicts between India and Pakistan, hopefully from an academic level and hopefully with a US perspective. And we're going to use Google for that. It's a completely worked out strategy. It's live. I hope to show you the results live, if that works, because you never know. And at the end of this particular sheet, you will have on paper here, and it will be on the website, a completely worked out strategy on how to bring down 10 million hits to a couple of hundred with increased relevance, because that's what you want. You want low recall and high relevance. Now, the first thing we do is we're going to do a search on India, the second search on a synonym for India, which in this case is New Delhi. I always advise to not just search for the country name, but also for the capital if you're looking for political documents, because in many newspaper articles, journalists don't say that Mr. Trump has decided to do something, but that the White House has said, or the government has said, and they all mean, in this case, the same thing. So with an OR operator, India or New Delhi, you create in Google one set of documents that contains either India or New Delhi, which may look like this. Now, if you look at this, and if you can see that, it returns 25 million documents, assuming that therefore the query is okay and we are happy. What you don't see here is that there's a major blunder in this query because there is no quotes around New Delhi. Actually, this says in Google language, India or New and Delhi, because the space means and. The query should be something like this. And in this case, you get much, much more documents. Have a look. Not 25 million, but 850 million, roughly 20 times more. Again, these blunders are easy to make, and even I make them all the time. That's why I can show them to you and tell funny stories about them. India or New Delhi. We do the same with Pakistan, Islamabad or Pakistan or Islamabad. Look at the result list to see if the number of results is what we expect it to be. And we look very, very quickly, do our search terms actually appear in the result list? Because if it doesn't, there's something wrong. Going back to the queries, we then continue because we were not interested in just India or Pakistan. We want documents that contain either India or New Delhi. Oh, that's the wrong query again. Bang. Here's the good one, number 9, India or New Delhi and Pakistan or Islamabad. Hopefully to reduce the results because that's what we want. Let's have a look. And if all's well, I don't find 800 million documents, but just 26 million. Which is obviously way too much. I can't read 26 million. And that's why this strategy success of fractions was made up. So what we do now in Google, and Google is a very simple and very primitive database with a very simple search language, but you can do pretty smart things anyway. And I'll show you how to do that. In number 10, I'm going to say to Mr. Google, can you please limit the search results to title words only by preceding every term with the phrase in title colon. Entitled India or entitled New Delhi, entitled Pakistan or entitled Islamabad. The assumption is if the words are in the title, then therefore the document is about these countries, which doesn't have to be the case, but we have to find something to bring down the documents, the number of documents. And if you look at the result list, you will see here that results go down dramatically to 500,000 even. And we will see that indeed Islamabad is in the title together with here New Delhi. And in this case here, India in the title together with Pakistan. It seems to work. I haven't opened up a single hit yet. That's not the issue right now. I first want to fine-tune my query and fine-tune the result list until the relevance is high enough for me. I don't, like a madman, open up one link after the other. Too much. So I'm going to have a look at the result list and see that there is indeed a conflict between India and Pakistan. And that conflict is called cricket. There we go. Which is indeed a conflict, but that's not what I mean with a conflict. So in my previous query, I would like to say to Google, well, do the query again, but this time throw out all the documents about sport by using a not operator spelled in Google with a minus symbol. And in this case, Google will throw out everything about sport. It will hopefully therefore increase relevance and decrease the documents. There we go. It's still 500,000, roughly the same as it was, but no sport anymore. I can check that very, very quickly to look for this cricket. And what we see is that cricket is still in there because cricket is not sport. That's to say, according to Google, cricket is not sport. So we'll go back to our query and look for synonyms and spelling variations of what we consider is sport should not be in our query. In this case, I also throw out cricket. Let's have a look at how that improves results a little bit. And now it goes further down, less than 500,000, and cricket is gone as well. Let's have a look if sport was thrown out, because there's something funny there. No, no sport, which looks good. It doesn't mean that it really works, but if I had found the word sport here, I would have had a problem. 500,000 is still too much, so we're going to try and increase relevance a little bit more by making yet another assumption. And that the assumption is that there is many, many documents in there about cheap holidays, beach holidays, cheap airline tickets, etc. And I want to find a trick to throw them all out. And I can do that by saying search in the URL field for either .com or .net top-level domain names, and with a not operator, throw them out. Now, in this case, I'm going to lose many relevant documents, but that's exactly what I want, because I can't read 400,000 relevant documents. I must limit myself to just a few hundred. So let's throw these out. And then something happens that I already feared. I have to tell Google that I'm not a robot because this is very suspicious behavior. Am I in luck? I am in luck. Knock, knock, knock. And you can see here, very funny, that I indeed don't have .com or .net. And what's even more interesting, that the relevance, if I look at the URLs, is going up already. And I'm not even finished. I can see a Daily Yo, I can see here Rusi, which is what I like to read, businesstoday.in, is that a top-level domain for India? So we have the Indian viewpoint towards this issue. I'm getting happier. But I'm not happy yet, because it's too many hits. How many do we have there? Let's have a look. We have 120,000 results, I can't read that. So we can make this a little bit more relevant by saying, well, assume two more assumptions. One, high quality, because we wanted high quality information. High quality documents are published in reports, and reports are published in PDF. Two assumptions that you must write down, because in a second round, we have to do this the other way around. So we limit our search results to PDF documents only. Let's see how that influences the number of results down to 5,000. And indeed, I have PDF documents only. All with India and Pakistan in the title. There's no .com, no .net. Peacemaker, UnitedNations.org there, Treaties, United Nations there. I am getting happier. Carnegie Endowment for Peace here. It indeed looks much better. There's even the CIA here popping up. I am happier. But that's still too much. So we're going to actually add something else there, limiting the results by saying I want only documents from a .edu top-level domain name by using Google Site Operator. Now, this is not about tricks in Google. This is about the assumption I make and the reasoning behind all this. That's much more important than using all these little stupid tricks. Let's see how that influences results. I'm going down here, and I am here looking at 69 results. And what do I see here? Sightseer there, always interesting. Muse, Johns Hopkins University. Brookings coming up. I want to read Brookings, all right. University of Pennsylvania there. A couple of documents. Rutgers, EDU. It looks great. It looks even better than it already did. But I've got 69 results, which is a bit low. I'll show you, and this is really funny, how to actually increase or triple the number of results by not changing the query. I'm going to triple the number of results by not changing the query. I'm going here to settings. In search settings, I'm going to tell Google, Mr. Google, will you please not show me 100 results per page, but just 10 results per page by dragging this slider to the left-hand side. I'm going to save the number of results, and boom, and now Google comes back with more than 200 results with exactly the same query and exactly the same database. Don't ask me why this is. I've heard a couple of explanations there, but none of them actually make much sense. Finally, I can actually say here, I'm not interested in just EDU, but also in .org websites, because all these Brookings institutions, CSIS, and all these fantastic think tanks typically have a .org top-level domain name to increase the results a little bit, to make the relevance a bit higher. Let's have a look there at the results. 1,500 and, again, 100 results per page. Did something wrong there. And if you now look at the sources, you can see it looks much better than it did. If you look at the titles, I can see it is mainly about conflicts between India and Pakistan. Relevance is about 90% instead of the 1% we had. And I have not even searched on the word conflict. I have also completely ignored Kashmir and all the rest. You don't actually need that for this top-down success fraction strategy. With that, I can continue my search. If I find interesting author names in that result list, I could go to a citation index and do a search on the author name to see how often or how many other authors, how many other documents were published citing the current one. Now, if I look at this particular document here, the India-Pakistan conflict, an enduring rivalry, if you look at this link here, it says here, cited by 149 others. It means that if I click on this link, I find 149 results that all cite this particular book. Again, assumption, hoping that therefore the 149 are roughly about the same subject. The big advantage is that I find many, many new authors, many new documents, and many new sources that I can all use for my new searches and for my research. Google Scholar is but one citation index. Your library has the Science Citation Index and many, many other much better citation indexes. Don't forget to use them. What you may also want to do is then go to, let's say, WorldCat to look up which other works were published by Mr. Paul in this case, about not 25,000 as it says here on screen. There's just a couple of dozen. I don't know why they say 25,000. He's not that good in writing. He's good, but not that good, not productive, not that productive. To find what else has Mr. Paul written, you can actually then also extract co-authors there to make sure you get a very good insight in this particular information profile. If you want to go a step further, you can actually say, well, if we now know Mr. TV Paul, what he has written and how much he cited, I'd like to stay updated on what he does now. In comes Mr. Twitter. Follow his accounts, have a look at his tweets and what he publishes to know exactly what he's doing. Maybe you want to have a look at who he follows, 338 other experts followed by Mr. Paul, hoping again that these are experts in some international relation as well. And in this case, you can, if you do it like this, make a collection plan, do it systematically, do it structured, do it planned, you can go pretty far in making a very nice information position. Lastly, I'd like to draw your attention to the Research Repertorium, the Open Source Intelligence Resource Discovery Toolkit, which is available online at this address, rr.reuser.biz, rr.reuser.biz. It's a collection of hundreds of internet search engines here on your left-hand side, the deep web search engines, premium sources like catalogs, vendors and bibliographies, reference works that are used to find good keywords, etc. And here, all kinds of sources arranged by subject, country information, government information, news websites, newspaper websites, etc., etc. This is the source I typically use to search the open source domain. With which I like to propose to close down my contribution to Intel Hub. I have spoken about what OSINT actually is. At least in my humble opinion, I've said something about a relationship between secret information. I have tried to put Google into perspective, fantastic company, fantastic search engine, but there's many, many others out there that you should also know. I've shown you something about the information, open source information landscape, and I've shown you two examples. And with that, I'd like to close down.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that great overview, Arno. I think, it really does. I really appreciate the practical side of it. especially the quirks when it comes to utilizing Google. So one question that has come up is, what resources would you recommend for people looking to get started in using the deep web or dark web? It's a constant thing that seems to come up in the classroom where students are interested, but they're also afraid. So what advice would you give to them?
Right. Being scared is indeed a very healthy attitude. Always be careful when you open up somebody else's website, especially in a criminal environment like Tor. The first thing you do is you use another laptop. You use a clean laptop that is not connected to your own network in any way. With that laptop, you go to the Starbucks or any public Wi-Fi network, and you make use of their network, not your network at the university, to make sure that your customers have all the crap, pardon my English here, and not you. They have all the things on their network, all the criminal stuff, and it will not be on your network. Thirdly, you download the appropriate software, which is for free. It is not illegal. You can do whatever you like. You install it. It's basically a browser that you get back, a Tor browser, which is just a Mozilla Firefox. You run it, and you can then dive into a domain of illegal trade, illegal merchandise, etc. A small part of Tor is also for investigative journalists who publish things in countries where they can't publish freely, etc. But in my humble opinion, 90% is serious crime. With serious crime, I mean, if I can give that as a warning, you will encounter websites where you can actually hire little children for the weekend, delivered on a Friday evening and collected on a Monday morning or whatever is left of those little children. I can't handle that. I can't emotionally handle that. So be careful what you open up. For the rest of it, nothing wrong. Does this answer the question?
Thanks for that. Yes, no, that does answer the question. I think that's a good starting point for anybody interested in taking a look at what those sources have to offer. Are there any additional questions in the chat? I know Arnold covered a great deal of things, so I'm taking a look at the chat to see if we're all caught up on questions. So if you have anything, have any burning questions, now is the time to ask them.
Please do. Don't be shy. I can't see you.
I think it looks like...
Please pardon the interruption. Your conference contains less than 3 participants at this time. If you would like to continue, press star 1 now, or the conference will be terminated.
The chat room is there predictive analysis capability?
I missed this question. Can you, again, please?
Yes, so Chris is asking, is there a predictive analysis capability?
Is there?
Chris, are you asking accuracy of the information, or what are you looking for specifically?
I don't understand the question. What do you mean, is there?
Yeah, Chris he's adding more right now. I can see him typing.
Is there a predictive analysis capability? Well, in an OSINT process, he means? What does he mean?
Yeah, he's still typing out the rest. Right. I think he's adding some information. So can the machine follow global megatrends or follow crime trends is what Chris is asking. Or perhaps there's a source that looks for trends.
That depends a little bit, the childish answer on what exactly a global megatrend is and what a crime trend is. And it's human beings who actually decide on that. If you can define the subject crime trends, if you can, or migration, yeah, it could be a lovely example. You have to define exactly what do we want to know with migration. Is it the numbers of people coming to our country or going away out of our country? Is it numbers divided by race, by color, by whatever? You have to define this migration. And if you do that, you can run monitoring services if you know which sources to use. If you're interested in numbers, you have to find a source for the numbers. If you want to know about the pressure on a society due to migration problems, we need another source. So it depends completely on the question and the source that you're going to use. Predictive analysis capability is not in open source Intel, as far as I know. That's typically something that's done by human beings. All that fancy software out there that claim an analysis capability, typically what they do is some frequency analysis or statistical analysis, and that's about it. Very important, very handy, very useful, but it's not analysis.
Perfect. I think that that's a good way to think about that. I see Chris is typing again, and he says, thank you for that response. Anything else while we have Arno with us? I know we have a few minutes before the end of the session, but if not, thank you guys all for attending today. I know it was very informative, and if you have any follow-up questions, just send them to me, and if Arno will engage us, then maybe he'll follow up with some answers for you. Arno, thank you again for joining us at our Intel Hub, and we all look forward, those of us that get to see you in the UK, we look forward to seeing you in September.
Thank you very much for having me, and very much looking forward to meeting all of you in Leicester.
All right, everybody. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of your mornings or evenings, wherever you are. Thanks again.